Mike Willenborg, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's quite a privilege.
Yeah, well, great to speak to you, man. Great to have this opportunity. So grateful to a mutual friend who set this up. And I know you're actually an American, but you're visiting my beautiful home country, South Africa, for a little bit of time. So you're actually not that far away from me, but it just so happens that it's still easier to do this virtually. But
yeah.
I thought we could have an interesting conversation on the hiddenness of God. And I have a bunch of questions I want to ask you relating to this topic. But before we jump into it, I think for anybody watching, could you just provide maybe a little bit of a brief background on who you are, what you do, what kind of work you do?
Sure. Well, at the moment, I'm actually busy with attempting to write a dissertation on abortion, actually. Figured I'd pick something uncontroversial, you know.
Yeah.
But so I'm a student in philosophy at Baylor University. I'm, as I say, trying to work on the dissertation, but I tell people that I'm not sure which is going to happen first, me finishing the dissertation or Jesus returning. Of course, if it's the latter, then I don't have to worry about the dissertation. So we'll see if he bails me out. But it's a lot of fun. And before that, I got a master's at Western Michigan University, where I studied under Tim McGrew, who does a lot of work on applying modern probability theory to the historical reliability of the Gospels, and particularly the resurrection of Jesus. So that was a lot of fun to be able to really dig into that material. And before that, I was in seminary at a small school in North Carolina. And so I've basically just been able to, for the last number of years, think about really fun things, and it's been a real blessing, and I couldn't be happier to be doing it. At some point, though, I worry that the luck may run out and I might have to actually get a real job, but we'll see what happens.
Great, man. Thanks for sharing. Well, on the topic of divine hiddenness, just to jump straight into it, given your background, given the kind of fun things you are thinking about, I know divine hiddenness is one of them. You met me on the street and I just knew nothing about divine hiddenness. I'm a total beginner. And I overheard you talking about this strange alien concept. And I just said to you, hey, I'm just kind of curious, what is this divine hiddenness thing you're talking about? How would you answer that?
Right. Well, in sort of modern analytic philosophy, the argument from divine hiddenness, as it's sometimes called, goes back to a fellow named John Schellenberg in a book that he wrote, the title of which I believe is Divine Hiddenness and Human Reason. And divine hiddenness, as he defined it in that book, is the idea or the claim that there are people who are open to relationship with God, and yet who don't have that relationship. In fact, who don't even have theistic belief. That is to say, they don't even believe that God exists, and yet they're the sort of people who would embrace God's existence and would embrace relationship with God if the evidence were clearer to them. And so the puzzle, Schellenberg thinks, is to explain why there are such people, if indeed there is such a God. And in fact, he thinks that if there is a God of the sort that Christians worship, then you just wouldn't have any people like this. That is to say, you wouldn't have people that he describes as non-resistant non-believers. That is, people who are not indisposed to God. That is, they're not resistant to the claim that God exists or that God loves them. They simply don't find the evidence for God's existence sufficiently compelling. So Schellenberg thinks, if God did exist, there wouldn't be any such people, but he thinks it's obvious that there are such people, and so he thinks this shows that there is no such God. And so, of course, the response to this sort of argument has centered on the two premises, right? The first premise being that if there were a God of the sort that Christians profess to worship, then there wouldn't be any people like this, And then the second premise being that there are people like this. People have challenged both of these premises. And so that back and forth has occupied the sort of center stage in the discussion of this argument since it was developed in the 1980s, I believe. But now people are starting to think that this is maybe not the best way to frame the phenomenon. We shouldn't think of it as a deductive disproof of God's existence or as a deductive argument against God's existence. We should instead think that the phenomenon of divine hiddenness is merely something that lowers the probability of God's existence, even if it doesn't show conclusively that God doesn't exist. And of course, many theists are inclined to reject even that more modest conclusion, but at the same time, other theists are willing to accept that it might be some evidence against God. And they simply say that when we factor in the total evidence still weighs heavily in favor of God's existence, even if there is some evidence of God's non-existence.
So it's not just that we don't visually see God with our visual senses. It's also just perhaps this, I think you said, non-resilient non-believer.
Non-resistant non-believer. So the
Not.
idea is that there are people who would like to believe that God exists, who would want to embrace God if his existence were clear to them. And yet, for such people, or at least for many such people, God's existence isn't clear to them. And so the question that Schellenberg and that others have posed is why this state of affairs would be the case. And of course, many Christians may look at the biblical evidence and say, or at least they would question whether it is so clear that there are such people, right? I mean, you have various passages of scripture, for example, Romans chapter 3, verses 11 and following, that seems to say that there aren't any people who seek after God, that there isn't anyone righteous, there's no one who seeks after God, this sort of thing. But I take it that Schellenberg and others who follow his line of thinking with respect to this argument, just take that to be an implausible empirical claim. And so theists, in response to Schellenberg, have, on the one hand, tried to say, actually, it's not so implausible. Self-deception is a very common phenomenon. And the tricky thing about self-deception is that the people who are self-deceived give no readily apparent evidence of being self-deceived. That's what makes it so hard to discern, right? And sometimes people have to undergo many hours of therapy in order to figure out that they've deceived themselves about certain things, right? And so if we have other passages like, I believe it's Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 17, that talks about the heart being desperately wicked and who can understand it and this kind of thing, then you wonder, well, should we be so confident? Do we have the right to be so confident that there are any of these non-resistant non-believers out there? But then you have other people who've thought, even if there are, it's not so clear that this is very good evidence against God's existence. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit if you want, you know, why they would push back against that claim.
I think what I wanted to get at is like these non-resistant non-believers, it's not like when we say God is hidden, we it's not just that we mean like, oh, I don't see him like hovering above the clouds or something like that, like visually, but also like perhaps just progressing forward with the idea that you have a legitimate non-resistant non-believer. He's alone in his room at night. He's had a rough day. He's broken. He wants to believe. He gets down on his knees. He prays. It's sincere. It's authentic. Tears are streaming down his face. The hiddenness we are talking about also means that in that moment, there might be hiddenness in the sense that he's not going to get a response that he experiences. But then I guess that the other point would be, well, maybe he does feel something, but then he kind of just dismisses it as, oh, well, that was just an emotion that happened to hit me at that moment. So to my thinking, it might also be that, you know, the individual might have a specific way of framing situations and events that he might be predisposed, even though he's non-resistant to belief, he might also be predisposed to always look at things through a more skeptical lens, kind of like the guy who's stuck in a blizzard. And then he says to God, please come and help me. And then Eskimos come out of nowhere and save him. And then in the bar, a few hours later, he tells this guy, you know, these Eskimos came and saved me when I called for God. And he said, and the other guy says, well, surely you must believe in God now. And then he says, no, man, that was just a bunch of Eskimos that happened to come through in the blizzard, right? So his perceptual framing could that also fall into that kind of self-deception, the way we frame
things? Indeed, right? I mean, there's a degree, and figuring out the precise nature of this is tricky. But it seems like there's a degree of our own will that influences the way we perceive things, the kind of evidence we take to be relevant, the kind of evidence that we weigh over against other kinds of evidence. And these sorts of things can affect how we rate the plausibility of theistic belief. And so in some respects, we have more, or at least we may have more, capacity to influence how we think about things than we might initially have thought. And so that's why, you know, Jesus says, for example, in Matthew chapter 7, that to the one who knocks, the door will be open. He doesn't say the door will be open as soon as you get to the door. You've got to knock. And if I'm remembering the Greek, tense of the verb, one way to understand it is you have to keep on knocking. It's not just a matter of knocking once and then the door's open. There's some persistence that may sometimes be called for. And there may be many reasons that God has chosen to set it up that way. But one reason he might have set it up that way is so that we can guard against this kind of self-deceptive tendency that we might have, that we can sometimes hide from ourselves the kind of things that we're doing, right? It's like if you try to get yourself to go to sleep, right? Various kinds of things you'll do to try to induce sleep. But to the extent that you're successful at doing that, you're going to forget that that's what you're doing, right? And of course, by doing that, you'll eventually fall asleep. But so it may well be that we can engage in practices that obscure our own intentions, hide our own intentions from ourselves. And as a way of preventing us from doing that, or at least making it harder for us to do that, God may make it a condition of his disclosing himself to us, that we seek him in this more active fashion. But there have been other proposals as to what God might be up to in setting things up that way. And we can talk about some of those as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd love to. Let me just ask you this question. It's so the idea that God is hidden, that's not really disputed, right? I mean, we pretty much kind of reach a point where we go, well, yeah, I mean, it does seem, even for believers, there are days where you have, I mean, when I think of a dry season of prayer, I mean, I feel like that's probably just you coming to grips with that hiddenness that is ironically present.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, so you have, on the one hand, hiddenness to non-Christians, right? But also Christians experience seasons where God's existence is less evident to them as it might be at other points in their life. And so there's actually maybe distinct phenomena of hiddenness in terms of a felt absence of God when you might have expected to feel him, even if you do believe that God exists, versus a perceived ambiguity in the evidence for God's existence. And you might think that the responses to those different kinds of hiddenness would be different. But as to your question, I mean, I think even the Bible says God is hidden, right? Isaiah chapter 45, verse 15, if I'm recalling correctly, says that God is a God who hides. And Jesus, in one of his parables, or rather, his disciples ask him why he uses parables. Why do you speak in parables? And he quotes from Isaiah chapter 6. And one of the reasons he gives is so he could deliberately obscure the truth of his message to some people who might incur greater judgment upon themselves by rejecting a clearer revelation, right? Because they aren't properly disposed to God. So part of the reason God may hide himself is actually out of God's own mercy, so that people wouldn't be as guilty as they would be if he were to clearly reveal himself to them, and then they reject that.
Okay. So that's like one reason why hiddenness is so evident. Forgive the paradox. So what is the kind of most respected or most kind of held up response or reason given as to why God would do this? Is it the mercy? Is it free will? What is it?
Well, I mean, you get a number of different responses. One that I like, that's a fairly recent one, is that God gives the church some responsibility in how clear the evidence is going to be to someone, right? Just as God could, if he wished, he could snap his metaphorical fingers and evangelize everyone himself, right? He could raise up stones to cry out. He could simply, as he may do in various countries in the Middle East, right, where he, you know, people claim to have visions of Jesus, where he comes and presents the gospel to people directly, right? I mean, he could do that to everyone, and there would be no need of evangelists or anything of the sort. But God has chosen to use the church as an instrument of his spreading the gospel. And there might be various reasons for that, right? It may be that by enlisting us in that way, this is allowing us to have a stake in what he's up to have greater responsibility for the spiritual well-being and welfare of other people, which is a good thing, to have a share in how other people are faring, to have a kind of sense of community, not just with respect to those inside the church, but a sense of community with respect to humanity more generally, the sense that we all have a stake in each other, and that we're all responsible in some measure for each other's well-being. And so if you think God has these good reasons to set things up this way, such that he's not simply evangelizing everyone himself, but that he uses other people to do that. And if you think in general that's a good thing for him to do, then it would make sense that he would leave up to the actions of various Christians, right? How clear the evidence for his existence and character might be to someone, right? That some people may have a more obscured picture of God if they've encountered folks who, either through imbibing bad theology or through making poor arguments or through living in a way that is shameful and that doesn't provide a great witness of Christ in their life, people may have less evidence than they would have had otherwise had they encountered different sorts of people. And so you might think, just as God leaves the quality in some respects of evangelism up to us, at least for a time, he may also leave the state of the evidence as someone perceives it up to us as well, at least for a time, right? I mean, I do believe, as we mentioned before, that Jesus says to everyone who knocks, the door will be open. He says in John chapter 7 that anyone who wills to do God's will know whether the message that Christ speaks is on his own authority or whether it's from God. He says, you know, when he's being nailed to the cross, he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Now, we need to be a little careful there. I do think there's a textual variant there, if I remember. But you see this same kind of theme reiterated many times, that God is not in the business of condemning people because they don't have the right sort of information. If anyone is ultimately apart from God, it's because of their sin and because of their choice to be apart from God. And anyone who wishes to be in union with God, God will do what needs to be done to get that person the evidence. And we see this sort of thing in Scripture itself with Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. And we see many stories throughout history of people receiving visions where they're told to go find a specific sort of person who will then give them the gospel, and they find this person and they get the gospel and they believe. So, and even various scriptures talk about, for example, 1 Peter 3:18 or 19 rather, says Jesus went and preached to spirits in prison after his crucifixion. Now there's a whole lot of debate, as I'm sure you know, about what precisely he was up to there, but it's at least possible that either shortly after death or at the moment of death or just before death, God makes these things evident to people. And so we needn't think that God is ever going to leave anyone in this kind of lurch forever, but he may have good reasons for allowing the church some responsibility, at least for a certain window of time, for how clear the evidence is going to be to someone.
Yeah, so divine hiddenness is something to contend with and perhaps even wrestle with, but it's not something to have misery over or complete dread over at the end of the day.
No, in fact, I think to the extent that we are motivated by this phenomenon to look into arguments for God's existence, to weigh the evidence very seriously with a prayerful attitude, we can often come to a place where the evidence gets less murky. My own experience was like that. Granted, I was a Christian at the time, but you have periods of doubt where you have to check to see whether this thing that you believe is something you're believing because it's how you were raised or influenced by your culture or this sort of thing, or do you really have good independent reasons to think this is true? And by embarking on that kind of search, many people have afterwards said that it's really strengthened their faith, and that it has, if not completely eliminated the phenomenon of divine hiddenness for them, it has greatly reduced it, as in fact it has done for me. But of course, as I say, there is the phenomenon of divine hiddenness even in the lives of believers. And there, I think we can say that, look, this is something even Jesus himself experienced on the cross, where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And if the Son of God has to experience that, then to me it's not that surprising that if I'm wanting to be in union with him, I might have to experience some of it too.
Jordan Peterson and Slavoj Zizek had that famous debate, and in the debate Zizek actually references Chesterton. He actually calls Chesterton his favorite theologian, and in Orthodoxy by Chesterton brings up that point you just made, which is that Christ on the cross calling out to God, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Christ being two natures within his human nature, living the life of a perfect human. If Christ does that, that kind of implies that even if you as a Christian, even as an atheist, are in that situation where you feel separated from God, where you feel God is completely hidden to the point where you would even feel he's betraying you, that even God himself, in a paradoxical way, undergoes that, goes through that. And right. So Zizek kind of draws this conclusion that feeling separate from God is actually a part of divinity itself, that feeling of hiddenness is part of the relationship that you have with God as a Christian, and that's actually, as you've mentioned a few times now, that's for the better. There's a greater good that'll be derived from that than if you knew God. And that really brings me to the next kind of point I want to explore with you, which is that, you know, if some people think that the reason God remains hidden is because if God was omnipresent to us, because he is omnipresent, but if he was omnipresent just, you know, everywhere, then that would in some way violate our free will. Because would we really be acting, would we really be free to reject God or to even be free to really love God if we knew he was right there? What do you think of that kind of approach, that the divine hiddenness is a necessity because it maintains the integrity of our free will?
Yeah, so Eleanor Stump, in her book Wandering in Darkness, and I think maybe in some other places, has said that love, whatever else it may involve, and of course, if I'm remembering correctly, she gets this from Aquinas, and she says, whatever else it may involve, it involves a union between the lover and the beloved, right? And it's got to involve then a union of wills. And in order to have a union of wills, you have to actually have two wills involved. And if God was as present to us as he could be, then you might think, given that God is our greatest good, he's the end for which we were made, this kind of thing, that this would have the effect of compelling us towards him, and would therefore render it such that there wouldn't be two wills involved, there would only be one. There would be God's will, and ours would just kind of be at the mercy of his and not functioning on its own. Yeah. And so if that turns out to be right, then you might think that in order for us to be able to love God, to be in union with God, there has to be at least initially a kind of hiddenness, at least in some respects, so that we can make the choice to love God. And okay. I find that pretty plausible, at least on most days of the week.
On most days, just not Thursdays for some reason. Yeah. Okay, good. So,
Well, I mean, one thing you have to wonder about, right, is, for example, angels, right? I mean, it seems like they have their own wills. Were they created at some distance from God? Maybe they were, but it's not exactly clear how that would go. And so you just kind of wonder about the mechanics of this kind of thing. But in general, it seems right to me that in order to love, you have to have two wills involved. And if one is necessarily at the mercy of the other or controlled by the other, then it's not really operating as its own will. And so you wouldn't actually have love in that kind of situation.
Yeah, it might just be my temperament, but I tend to place a lot of value on intuitive understandings or intuitive apprehensions. And to me, that seems like a fair intuitive apprehension, right? That, it seems to make sense. There's nothing in me that seems offended logically by that idea, right?
Well, okay, and what's interesting about this is by reflecting on this, you might be able to see that it's actually important that each person of the Trinity shares the same will, because if they have different wills, then if this point about love is correct, they'd have to be at some distance from each other, which seems false, right? But if you say they actually have the same will, then you don't have that kind of conundrum, because the union of the persons isn't a union of numerically distinct wills. It's just the one will.
Yes. In contrast to us and our relationship to God,
exactly,
which is we have our own separate will, which
That's
causes us all of our problems. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. That makes sense.
Yes.
Okay. So you mentioned Schellenberg at the beginning. He kind of started this whole thing off. Are there any other big thinkers in this domain of divine hiddenness that have, you know, contributed to this conversation in a big way?
Yeah. So now, actually, I have to say, a professor of mine at Baylor, Charity Anderson, is trying to push the discussion of divine hiddenness in a different direction from Schellenberg, and to say that we really ought to construe the phenomenon probabilistically and not as a deductive argument, but as something that can maybe lower the probability that God exists, but that shouldn't be thought of as conclusively disproving the existence of God, because it's perhaps too easy to imagine possible scenarios, possible justifications that God might have for allowing this kind of thing. And if you frame it as a deductive argument, then you might think that's all you need is a possibility to diffuse the argument. So she wants to say, no, we should just think of it as something that may bear on the probability that God exists, but that doesn't rise anywhere near the level of a disproof. The sketch I gave earlier about our responsibility for each other in terms of how we end up seeing the evidence, that is something that's developed more fully by a philosopher named Dustin Crummett. And I believe he's given an interview where he develops this line of thought. So if you put in his name in YouTube with divine hiddenness, you should be able to find it there.
Okay. Fascinating. Well, I have one last question for you on this topic, Mike, and that's just, is there any way to kind of, was any relationship, let me think about how I'm going to phrase this, in terms of suffering in the world and in terms of divine hiddenness, is that a conversation that's happening regularly in terms of the fact that God seems so hidden? Does that seem to contribute, as you just mentioned, does that seem, when taken in combination with the suffering of the world, divine hiddenness plus suffering equals higher probability that God does not exist. Is that a conversation that's being had? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think here the gospel has some pretty powerful things to say, right? So we have, for example, Romans chapter 8, verse 29, which says that one of the destinies for the Christian is to be conformed to the image of Christ, right? So you think about what that means, and whatever else it means to be conformed to his character. It means to have a Christ-like disposition, a Christ-like way of responding to things, a Christ-like way of being, of living, this kind of thing. And if you think in accordance with Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, I think it is, that says Jesus had to learn obedience through the things that he suffered, and that opens up its own can of worms. But if you think that's true, then you think, well, goodness gracious, if God the Son, for some complicated reason, had to learn obedience through suffering, then if I want to be like him, I'm probably going to have to face some of that as well. So when I experience divine hiddenness, or really any kind of suffering, I try to think this is, in a way, shaping me to be like Jesus. It's allowing me to share, in a way, in his suffering. In a way, it's allowing me to bond with him, to be united with him in a way that would be, if not impossible, at least very difficult, if my life was just as cushy as it usually is, right? I mean, if I never had any difficulty, then there would be something lost when I eventually meet Jesus face to face and haven't had those kinds of experiences where I've faced suffering and faced the kind of felt absence of God that he himself experienced on the cross. There's going to be a way in which I'll be closer to Jesus for having had that experience than I would be without having had it. And when I meet Jesus, I suspect that I'm going to be thankful for having had that experience, even if I can't exactly see now the way in which I'm going to find it fulfilling. I suspect mm-hmm. that when I'm actually meeting him face to face, we're in some way going to bond over those things, and it's going to be better than it would be if that hadn't happened.
Yeah, that makes
perfect
sense.
And then if you ask me, like, well, was it worth it? Was it worth having those moments so that you can now bond to Jesus or bond with Jesus more closely than you would be able to otherwise? I mean, it seems to me the question kind of answers itself. I mean, of course it is. And so when you keep that frame of mind, I mean, at least for me, helps me to endure the suffering more easily than I and more gladly than I would be able to if I didn't think that way.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense, man. It struck me now that while you were saying that, I mean, we are made in the Imago Dei, we're made in the image of God. And if we perceive a sort of divine hiddenness, or we don't perceive God and then call that divine hiddenness, it makes me think, you know, in the same way that's kind of imprinted on us in a way, because there's so many parts of your own personality that you just don't perceive that are completely hidden to you. And that goes back to a point you made at the beginning, right? It's almost like the microcosmic divine hiddenness of the self. Like a friend will be walking with you and they'll tell you something about yourself that you didn't realize, right? Your friend will be like, you know, you always say that, or you always do this, and you kind of, you're not aware of it. It's like an arrogant person doesn't know they're arrogant, right? Which is scary because it means any one of us could be like that, and we're just not aware of it. So I think it's not even just, you know, the hiddenness out there. There's a sense in which the self is hidden to itself.
Yeah.
And perhaps the hiddenness of God plus the hiddenness of the self are both necessary. I'm using that term very loosely. They're both necessary so that when you find yourself, and you'll do that through your encounter with Christ, that, like you say, it's just, it all makes sense. It was worth it. A greater good has come about due to this hiddenness.
Right. And I mean, I know, even as a Christian, even as somebody who firmly believes that God exists, that I hide from God all the time. Much to my shame, of course, but I have no doubt that I do this. And so if I know for a fact that I do this, then, sad as it is, I probably do it a lot more than I think I do. And so it's not hard for me to think that even if we might want to flatter ourselves and think, well, there aren't any of these non-resistant non-believers out there, or rather that there are some of them out there, it's not so clear to me. I mean, we're quite good at hiding from ourselves. We're quite good at hiding from other people. I know that I personally hide from God all the time. And so it's just doesn't seem, given all of that, it doesn't seem that improbable that we might all be hiding from God in various respects.
I think our sinful nature is actually grateful for God's hiddenness, you know? Probably a relief.
Perhaps it wouldn't always be good news for us if God was as present to us as he could be, right? I mean, you have that passage in Exodus, I think 34, where God tells Moses to tell the Israelites to basically go away, or he tells them they can't come up on the mountain because they would be destroyed by his presence. Now, I don't think that's because, you know, God's a big meanie. I think it's a matter of you get in the presence of complete holiness, and like Isaiah, you start coming apart at the seams, right? So this sort of scares me. I sort of start wondering about a Protestant purgatory, but that's maybe another discussion.
Well, I mean, Peter Kreeft, the Catholic philosopher, he also says that if you're close to God, you're probably not going to feel... your first instinct might not be, happiness. It might be just awe.
Yeah.
And awe doesn't necessarily feel happy. You might be shaking in your boots, right? So it's the same idea.
I'm shaking in my boots just thinking about it right now. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it's strange because on the one hand, it's you're shaking, but I also can't wait for the shaking. So,
yeah. Well, if you're going to walk on ice, you might as well dance, right? So, yeah. I think it's an interesting topic. I think it's, I don't know. Do you think it's a kind of complete topic? Like there's a full stop to it, like the divine hiddenness, like it's not going to develop anymore. Do you think we've kind of addressed it, or do you think there's still new avenues to explore in this conversation?
Oh, I mean, goodness gracious. I would never say that we've reached the last word on a topic until Christ shows up and is the last word on the topic. But until then, I'm sure there'll be more that's said on it that's worth paying attention to.
Perfect. Mike, I want to just ask you to share with the audience if you have any online work that people could go and check out. If you have anything like that, people could go and read up more about this, anything you'd recommend, feel free to share.
Oh, well, you know, I'm blessed that everybody who works on this stuff does a better job of it than I would ever do. So I'm happy to defer to them. And there's lots of good stuff out there. If you just put in Divine Hiddenness on YouTube, you'll come across a bunch of resources that are far superior to anything I could ever produce.
Okay. Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being here. And God bless, man. Thank you for your work. Keep it up.
No, thank you.